Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void. We're prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 299th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the outstanding actresses of her generation. A woman who seemingly came out of nowhere and became a star and America's sweetheart in Cameron Crowe's 1996 film Jerry Maguire, for which she received a SAG Award nomination. She has since shined in a slew of films, including Carl Franklin's One True Thing in 1998, the Farrelly Brothers' Me, Myself, and Irene, and Neil LaBute's Nurse Betty in 2000, winning a Golden Globe for the latter, Sharon Maguire's Bridget Jones's Diary in 2001, for which she received Oscar, Golden Globe, and SAG Award noms, and its 2004 and 2016 sequels, receiving another Golden Globe nom for the former, Rob Marshall's Chicago in 2002, for which she won Golden Globe and SAG Awards and earned an Oscar nom, Anthony Minghella's Cold Mountain in 2003, for which she won Oscar, Golden Globe, and SAG Awards, Ron Howard's Cinderella Man in 2005, Chris Noonan's Miss Potter in 2006, for which she received a Golden Globe nom, and most recently, Rupert Gould's Judy, a film about the last year in the life of Judy Garland, which had its world premiere at the Telluride Film Festival last month, in which she sings, dances, and looks just like the late showbiz legend, and for which she is already the clear frontrunner to win the Best Actress Oscar, a roller coaster 16 years after her last Oscar, the great Renee Zellweger. Over the course of our conversation in Zellweger's dressing room at Ellen on the Warner Brothers lot, where she had just taped her first talk show appearance in years, the 50-year-old and I discussed her rise to stardom, the work that went into the roles for which she is best known, why she felt compelled to take a six-year hiatus from the business between 2010 and 2016, what she makes of the revelations about Harvey Weinstein, who distributed many of her films, how she prepped to play Judy Garland in Judy, and what she makes of the fact that the performance is bringing her some of the best reviews of her career, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Renee, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Nice to see you. Thanks for asking me along.
Of course. So we always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I like that one. That's easy. I was born in Houston, and my mother is a midwife. She delivered babies in Norway, and she became a pediatrician's nurse when she came to America. And my father was an engineer. And I should say he is an engineer because that never changes, right? The brain of an engineer, once an engineer, always. He did mechanical and electrical. He built power plants and everything electronic in our home. From the turntable to the speaker systems to the televisions and everything. He built them with a soldering iron until he built our house.
So multi-talented family. And I was going back and reading stuff written about you ahead of this from, you know, the very beginning. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, I guess growing up in the part of Texas where you were from, like, what was it, nine or something on, it was a little bit remote. And you were saying to people that, you know, there wasn't necessarily that much exposure to acting and certainly to theater. I read a profile that somebody did with you after Jerry Maguire, and they went with you to a play, and you said that it was the first play you'd ever seen. So what was your exposure to this prior? I mean, obviously, must have been limited. So where did your desire to even get into this come from?
I think we can blame my brother. He started to take speech and drama as an elective in junior high school. And I worship my brother, and I still do in so many ways, and I wanted to be like him, so he played soccer, I played soccer. He just couldn't get away from me, so he started the speech and drama, and then so did I.
Did you immediately, was there a aspect of it? Was it a show or a part or something that hooked you?
No, not at that time. Yeah. I just loved the camaraderie, and I enjoyed, what were probably horrifically bad performances that, I was getting to do, and, the speech tournaments were really great. You hop on a bus and travel out of town with all your buddies really early, when it's still dark out on a weekend. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I never considered that it was going to be, a career choice.
So when you went off to the University of Texas, what did you imagine you would focus on there and do afterwards?
I thought I would write. I thought that I was going to be a journalist, and they have a fantastic journalism department at the University of Texas. It's been ranked among the tops for, since, time immemorial with the Daily Texan newspaper. And I never got around to submitting. I kept making up excuses why I just couldn't do it. Couldn't do it, couldn't...
To make it your major, you mean, or to...
No, to submit something, a sample, writing sample, to join the paper.
Okay.
And finally, I just had to, come to Jesus with myself and said, okay, now there's a reason that you're not doing this, because, where there's a will, there's a way, and you keep making up every possible excuse not to do this. So what's going on here,
And simultaneously, how did... acting while in college entered the picture, and to the extent that it sounds like it was while you were there that you got your SAG card, that you started making a few bucks to help pay for tuition. It all started going while you were there. So why?
Well, I had some photographer friends, and they would ask me to come and do photo shoots with them. And suddenly I had a book, and suddenly I had a commercial agent. And then that went from photographs to, I guess little commercials here and there. And then little bit parts with one line or two lines or whatever it might have been. And meanwhile, I needed to take an elective to get my degree and drama fit. So I just went to this class thinking it would be fun to revisit my old hobby, and it somehow became important to me.
Well, I read that there was actually a specific part in that case where, I don't know if it was even a moment you could pinpoint playing that part, but where you got hooked. The way it was described in one kind of early profile, you were doing a student thesis film, girl playing girl in a boarding house contemplating suicide. Why was that the part that hooked you?
Couldn't tell you.
Yeah?
No, I couldn't tell you. I don't know, the experience of trying to understand this person, this character, imagining what motivates her and living that life and what that might be like. Just storytelling. It just became this wonderful creative opportunity to explore this other life. And I, again, loved the camaraderie, the process of making this. And there were maybe five of us who were making this film in the sticks outside of Austin. And, the gaffer was the caterer, was the, teamster was the DP. And I held the boom for the other, things like that. And I really fell in love with that. And as the work started to sort of accelerate, and I was graduating and trying to decide if I was going to take the GMAT or the LSAT and keep going, I was working.
Well, in terms of film work, two of the first film roles, I think maybe the first two, were while you were still in Austin and with a classmate, I believe, who happened to be in both of those films with you, right?
All right.
Mr. McConaughey. So you just happened to know him in school, and you guys both wound up seeking professional film work and wound up in Dazed and Confused and a similar caliber film, Texas Chainsaw Massacre of the Next Generation?
No, I think it was accidental for both of us, actually. I can't remember what he said he was studying, but he met the producer of Dazed and Confused at the Hyatt in Austin.
Right, the bar.
And my understanding was that he was on a date, and then suddenly he was on a date with Don Phillips.
Right, right.
And that it was just a fun conversation, and he met this person who would essentially change his life.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I read the script, and I went for an audition for Dazed and Confused with Rick, and I thought, wow, you know, he goes to my school, and he's a film major, and this just seemed to make sense to me. And I didn't get cast in the film, but they did ask if I wanted to be a featured player.
So you were like, was it the girl on the car or whatever?
Girl in blue truck.
The girl in the blue truck, yeah.
So there's the high school girls,
right.
And then there's the peripheral high school girl in the blue truck.
The ones that keep him, whatever his line was.
Oh, right.
I get older, but they stay the same.
Yeah.
But there are those two early movies without much substance for you to really bite into. But then the first one that it seems like was a substantial part was, I believe, also in Texas, Love in 45. And that led to a lot of things, right? I mean, that was sort of the one that opened the doors.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. Yeah, it was.
And so, like, basically, before that came out is when you decide you're moving to Hollywood, or it was?
It was around the same time.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to move. I was going to stay in Austin because there's no good reason to leave Austin.
It's a nice
you
place.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was just going to stay and keep working in Texas if that was an option.
Yeah.
But I think the next couple of auditions that came down the pike were a commercial.
Mm-hmm.
One was for Long John Silver's and one was a regional. It was for, you know, it was a local commercial.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, but I've already done that.
Yeah.
And it felt like at that moment, I think I recognized that if I'm going to grow professionally, and I don't mean in terms of get from here to there.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm going to have new experiences, I might have to move.
So this is 1993. You get out there without representation when you arrive, right, in terms of film work. Mm-hmm. And the way I understood it, even though Love in a 45 had not necessarily been released theatrically, people were seeing it around town, and that was like your calling card. You got an agent as a result of that, and the next opportunity is because of that?
I guess so.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't aware of how things work.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know what the plan was, what I was thinking was going to happen, but the phone just started ringing.
Yeah.
And it went from there.
And so some of those early things would be like Reality Bites for Ben Stiller and some other.
I was still in Texas.
For that one, too?
Yeah.
Wow.
We were actually filming Chainsaw Massacre when I got the phone call to drive to Houston and meet this young new director. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy. I said young director.
Yeah.
I had no expectation that he was as young as he was.
Wow.
That was a really great experience.
And when you're out in L.A., yes, you're acting, but you're also, at that point, pre-Jerry Maguire having to make a living in other ways too, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And my friend hired me to be the barback at the Three Clubs on Vine, which is really, really sweet.
And so I guess that sort of gets to the point where I have to ask you who Gail Levin is.
Oh, yeah. She's a great person. Very kind and supportive and
just essentially like a casting director, right? It was her idea that Cameron Crowe see you?
I think that's right, yeah. I think that's right. She had spoken with John Corbino, who was my manager, my new manager at the time.
Yeah.
I think they were friends. And I guess she had seen The Whole Wide World, and she thought that maybe we should meet.
So I guess at this point, this is Cameron Crowe writing and directing, James L. Brooks producing, and the way that I've gone back to read some of their interviews and stuff at the time where they're saying for this part of Dorothy, the single mother and accountant who goes along eventually here professionally and romantically with Jerry Maguire, that they were thinking, we got to find somebody like Shirley MacLaine in The Apartment who can hold her own and all of that. And I guess I just wonder if you can take me through the casting process from the earliest call from Gail or whoever to getting the call that you had this part, which was going to change everything.
Yeah, that was a really fun time in life.
Yeah.
It was really fun because, you know, all of it was surreal. There's nothing to lose, and everything was really funny to me, you know, to get this phone call that, yeah, you're going to go down to Sony today, and they're going to let you in.
Yeah.
You're going to drive on the lot, and they're going to let you in. And this is how naive I am. I got to Jim Brooks' office, and he had the posters on the wall of all of his masterpieces, you know, Terms of Endearment. You know, the list is so long. And I thought he just had good taste.
You thought those were just things he liked.
I thought we love the same things.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, there you go.
Because at that point, you were, 20? This is 90. Seven. Yeah, 27.
Yeah. And no, it's 26. I'm
26.
Sorry. Yeah, it's 26.
New to town. And now, did you know? So your first thing, though, was meeting with Jim, or before that, there were some other earlier rounds?
I met Cameron.
Yeah.
And I met Lisa Stewart, who I like to say was his right-hand gal at the time, and remained one of my dearest friends. Yeah. But yeah, she was laying on the floor because she had a back problem at the time. But back was bothering her. She's wearing her denim skirt and clogs. I remember, we're going to be friends. And she said, don't be nervous. It's going to be fine, you know? And met Cameron. He's a music lover. And we just had
so much
in common.
For a part opposite Tom Cruise? Or did you not know that yet?
I did know. But, you know, I was just thrilled they let me on the lot.
Yeah, to just be...
And then to meet this really great guy.
Right.
He's so much fun. And he's so interesting and so fun to
We're
talk
about
to.
Tom.
Cameron.
Oh, Cameron.
Yeah,
okay.
This was the first day.
Yeah, the first day.
I just liked him so much.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was, I'm good now at this point. Because I had this great day.
Yes.
We played music. We traded stories about awesome music and, you know, what we liked. And it was such a fun day. So, and then I met Lisa Stewart. I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, life is golden.
Right.
And I had to get to work, you know, so off we go. And then I got a call that they'd like you to come back, you know, and John was my manager again. He's telling me they'd like you to come back. And
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, they want you to meet with Tom. And I started laughing. And I think I just kept laughing until I walked in the doors at Sony that next week or whatever it was. I drove there with the windows down and the music blasting, laughing the whole way. That
not
I
nervous?
Was, well, it was just surreal that they were going to let me on the lot again and that Tom Cruise is there. And he was waiting for me.
And was he somebody...
That's funny.
Was there a parallel to the characters in the sense that was he somebody that you had kind of come up liking or knowing about or whatever just as a moviegoer?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. And he's wonderful.
Yeah.
He's such a talented actor. And he always struck me as a really kind person.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's no disappointment in meeting him. He's very generous and kind and looks you in the eye and is authentically curious when he asks you questions.
Yeah.
And he just has a wonderful vibrancy about him.
Right.
And I don't know if you've met him. Have you met him?
He's actually one of the few. I've been lucky to do a lot of these interviews and meet a lot of people. He's one of the few that I've never...
He's on the list?
He's on the list.
Let's put it out there.
Yeah, it'll
Come
be
on,
great.
Tom.
We're putting it...
Come get on the couch. there's a reason. And he's a movie star.
Sure.
And you meet him and, you know, he's just a really great person.
Well, Cameron and Jim said that part of the thing they, among numerous things they liked about you, was that you didn't seem intimidated by him. A lot of people, I think, came in and maybe understandably are a little freaked out. But how do you explain that at 26 with no real experience, you were able to confidently hold your own?
Oh, I don't know. That's a really interesting question. I never thought about that. I don't know. I was just interested in him as a person.
Yeah.
And he struck me as just such a special person.
Yeah.
That, you know, the other stuff is great.
Yeah.
But who he is.
That was more. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did read, and there's not everything out there is correct, so I'm going to ask you to correct me if I'm wrong.
Oh,
here.
Let's not. It's so much more interesting.
Just to leave the legend? Or
yes.
Well, okay, so.
The only thing good, I was the joke, and this person said to me the other day, so when they make a story about your life one day, I said, they're not going to make a story about my life. And
Whoa.
She said, why? I said, because all the good parts are not true.
Well, this one is pretty amusing, but.
Aren't they all?
All of them, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, hit me. Let's
all right.
What do you got?
Your screen test. First time you're doing a scene with Tom.
Yes.
Apparently, he and Cameron quietly planned something to see how you would handle something.
I think I have a little bit of recall about that. And it was...
What are we talking about?
He actually did kiss me in the thing, but it's written on the page.
In the screen test?
So, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, it's like when you go in for auditions and stuff, and it says, now you fight, and grabs him by the throat, and blah, blah, blah. You know, you usually pantomime that stuff just to get around the awkwardness of it, and there's sort of an understood light of, like, I don't know, parentheses around it, that this will happen on the day, but right now you're just going to look like a jerk being really awkward in this fight scene.
He did it?
But, yeah. It was sweet.
Was that the extent of it?
It was sweet. Well, it was, well, you know.
All right, a little grabby. A little grabby.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Well, okay, next question. You get the part. Do you remember where you were when you got that part?
I was in Sundance with The Whole Wide World with Dan Ireland.
Yes.
Oh, and Vince D'Onofrio.
Yep.
Oh,
and you remember how you
and Woodrow
handled
it? The dog.
There was sort of I don't know again if it's true, but the story is a little, it's become kind of classic about how you responded to the news that you had the part.
Yes. Well, he played with me. Did he tell you
that? I didn't hear that part. I heard just
Okay. He called and he said
Cameron.
Yes. Yeah. And I thought, oh, that's really nice. That's really nice. That's takes a lot of character to call the person that you're going to let down personally.
Right.
I thought, I knew I liked this guy.
Right, right.
I knew he was a class act. And he was really apologetic in his tone. He said, hey, I'm really sorry that it took us, you know, a while to figure it out, and I want to tell you, you know, and he was going off on this whole long tangent. I'm like, just break my heart already. Just break my heart. Just hurry.
Right.
Hurry, I want to go get a hamburger.
Right.
Just break my heart. And, yeah, he kept going with that for a good minute of, you know, he did a great job, and, you know, really so great to meet you, and really love spending the time. And I just got to say, you know, we're just wondering if, you know, if you want the part.
And is it true, though? Supposedly you had said something like, what makes you think I want it? Or there was some, like,
no,
wisecrack.
I told him I would have to see if it fit in my schedule.
If it fit, right. Well, so that was obviously, you know, the beginning of a whole new chapter, I'm sure. And so I wonder, though, if people recall one scene from Jerry Maguire, it tends to be You Had Me at Hello. And Cameron was saying that you guys did that like 15 times. Why was that? And did you ever imagine that that scene would be something that would follow you for the rest of your life?
No, I didn't get past the day.
Yeah,
I just didn't want to disappoint him.
Right.
I wasn't sure what he was looking for, but I just hoped that we'd find it, you know? Yeah, and he does this thing, you know, he lets it roll so that wherever it is that you, whatever, I don't know, emotional place that you reach, you can just keep going from there.
Yeah.
And so it just kept rolling. He just kept it going, kept us in the room and kept in that thing. And he just, the delivery was different every time to get a different kind of thing. And then, I don't know, I started to feel it in a different way. And I started to understand what he was doing, because the truth of that exchange became so real to me. And it was overwhelming. It was magic that day.
Wow. And I mean, it sounds like, again, in his mind, he's going into that scene thinking Shirley MacLaine in the apartment. He said the line, shut up and deal, like the last line, it was sort of said dismissively. That's what he was kind of pushing you towards, right? But interesting. So you didn't go to the premiere. Which is interesting, because that, I feel like, how's that possible? But then the movie opens and it gets so well received. And you particularly, I wanted to quote back from the LA Times review, because this was pretty amazing. Quote, the buzz around co-star Zellweger has been intense ever since she was plucked from the independent film world to play opposite Cruz, and it's a pleasure to say she's worth the advance praise. Sensual and offbeat, with great relaxed comic timing and the ability to glow without being glamorous, Zellweger's way with the interplay of feeling and humor makes her the film's emotional center, close quote. So all of this is going on, you're getting so well received, movie opens. What do you remember of opening weekend and how things were different? It must have been almost immediately.
Wow. Well, not that. I don't remember that. I've never heard that before. That's really kind. Thank you.
Kenneth Turin.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. That's pretty special. I was working, so I hired a publicist just before that, Nancy Ryder, so she could tell everybody no for me because
You're getting bombarded?
Well, I don't think I was afraid. I just think that I was happy, and I didn't want my life to change dramatically. I didn't want to sort of court that attention in some way, or I didn't want it to get out of control in some way. I wanted my life to, you know, I it was quiet, and I wanted to find my way. I wanted to grow into that if I could.
Was it immediately where you went out to the supermarket or something and people were stopping you?
Well, I was busy, so I didn't spend a lot of time off the set for quite some time. You know, I was in New York making Price Above Rubies, and we were working 6 days a week, and we were rehearsing on the seventh, and getting up when it's dark, going home when it's dark, so it was really quiet.
Yeah.
And I got this wonderful tape that Tom had made of their European tour that they did, the press tour, and all the press that they did, and so I have the, on VHS, thank you very much. Yes, it was.
Well, the movie that you were off making at that time, as you said, A Price Above Rubies, of all things, you were playing a Hasidic Jewish housewife.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads into just one kind of chain of discussion that I wanted to ask you about, because I think with the possible exception of Nicole Kidman or Gwyneth Paltrow, I don't know if anybody ever worked as many times as you with... And I kind of say these days, like the late Harvey Weinstein. Miramax was a producer of that, and Chicago, and Bridget Jones, and Cold Mountain, and so many. And I just wonder, if it's not an appropriate question, did you ever feel that he was unprofessional around you, or was it? Because, I mean, this is spanning now, 98 is that movie, through pretty near the end. I covered him. We all dealt with him. I think people knew he was a bully, but there wasn't the sense that, from my point of view, that it went beyond that. Did you ever feel that he was unprofessional around you?
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please.
Did you interview him?
Numerous times.
And how is he to you?
He knew that he was going to see me every Oscar season, so he was never too mean to me or too rude to me. But he also, you know, would not behave the same way around media as others, maybe.
Why?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably just the obvious reasons, right? He doesn't want to... I think he did kind of like the persona of a swaggering, tough guy. But I mean, look, you were the one that I'm sure saw more of him with his guard down than I did.
But can I ask you one more
question? Yeah, of course.
What was he like with you?
Well, he was on this podcast before it. So we've been doing it. We just had our fourth anniversary. He was an early guest. It's still up there. And I dealt with him before. And I think, look, you cannot deny, right, that he certainly had good taste in movies most of the time and knew about this stuff. The fact that all the other stuff is obviously atrocious, but it doesn't change that. So from what I think people enjoyed having somebody colorful to report on, not knowing that there was this other side.
What? How would you describe him? What are the words you would use to describe him?
No, I mean, he's a slob, and I could see that he wouldn't be fun to work for, but he was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so now I'm turning it back on you.
No, keep going.
No, because I don't want to shortchange the rest of your career. We have so much more to talk about, but I just wanted to get... It's not in any way to... I know that a lot of people say they have no sense other than just that he could be a jerk and pushy. We had Kate Winslet on here, and she said that Oscar categories and things, you know, she felt she should be a lead and he would say supporting or whatever, different things like that where he would be mean, but he didn't necessarily get out of line.
Yeah, that's the guy that I knew. That's
just the bully?
Well, no, not the bully.
Yeah.
He was gruff
and
jocular.
Yeah.
And he made jokes about looking hot in that skirt,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't threatening, and it wasn't demeaning.
Yeah.
I knew that he was in this really awkward, uncomfortable way, trying to give me a compliment.
Yeah.
It never went further than that.
I'm glad to hear. It's been a sad thing because it makes you look back at all these great movies and the whole thing, and you don't know what to think anymore, I think.
it's a big conversation.
Yeah.
It's a very big conversation because, you know, I don't know, he was my professional collaborator and around really important things in my life.
Yeah. I left out Miss Potter. That's another one that...
Yeah. Yeah. And he was kind to me.
Right. Right.
And he was so generous with me.
Right.
And it felt authentic to me.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like that this was, what's the word, when you're conditionally kind because you want something, transactional.
Yeah,
yeah. It didn't feel like that.
Right, right. I know. I mean, and look, it's a very complicated person because all of the people who ever worked in his high levels of his PR or awards operations or any of the things that he's most known for, they were always women. And they felt they were treated very respectfully. He respected that they were the best people for those jobs. But obviously, there's this other side. But anyway, I take it all off course.
No. It's an important conversation.
Yeah.
And it makes me very sad.
Yeah.
Personally sad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sad for his family.
Yeah.
I'm sad for the women that were hurt.
Of course, yeah.
I'm sad for him.
Yeah.
And I wish him healing so that he can somehow try to make reparations for the damage that he's done.
Yeah, that's a crazy situation. Well, to come back to you, I want to ask you about after Jerry Maguire, suddenly you're this exciting new person in town. And it was interesting because that's normally when people like rush into a million things and sign up to, you know, they want to strike while the iron's hot. It seems like you took your time, and the first major part to come about as a result of that, I think, was One True Thing opposite Meryl Streep. Was there a calculation here? I want to make sure I don't rush into the wrong. I want to shape my career in a strategic way.
I don't know if it was as calculated as that. It felt like there were certain things that I was curious about, mm-hmm. and good stories was primarily what drew my attention.
Yeah.
And this was a great story, mm-hmm. and that Meryl Streep wants to do this film.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, can't beat that.
Right.
And I guess after that, the next big one would be Me, Myself, and Irene. With Mr. Carey, and I guess I wonder, had you really, in terms of a comedy and showing another side of yourself, that was probably the first time for something like that on, since you had a lot of eyeballs on you, right?
Maybe so. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. Was that the first real comedy?
But that's interesting, because that was also the same year as Nurse Betty, and
oh, yes.
Neil LaBute is not somebody who is known at that point for, you know, interesting female parts, and yet here was one for sure. I had read that even you were, you know, when you heard it was a piece of material from him, there was a sense like, I've got to see this to believe it, that it would not, because hadn't you seen some of those In the Company of Men and certain other things of his that might not have endeared him to you before that?
Oh, no, I was a fan. Yeah.
All right. Well,
no, it's because he's intelligent.
Yes.
And he's an original.
Yeah, definitely.
So when he's putting work out there, you think, oh, okay, he's starting a conversation
right,
here.
Right, right.
And I'd love to meet with him and find out why. And we ate pizza. And he's funny and warm and self-effacing and hilarious.
Which you would never necessarily get from the...
He was so funny and just a lovely man. And yeah, I mean, and obviously the writing is exceptional.
They showed a scene from that at your Telluride tribute a few weeks ago, and it's a reminder. I got to go back and rewatch the whole movie. But that was just—it seemed like a fun part to play. And then I guess
so great, Aaron and Chris Rock, and Morgan Freeman,
incredible.
Oh,
and so you won your first Golden Globe for that, and then I guess is the beginning of something that really spans a number of probably longer than any other single part you've ever, certainly than anything else you've had to do, which is Bridget Jones. This was, from what I had read, they're looking for someone for 2 years, and every British person, I'm seeing Kate Winslet, Rachel Weisz, Kristen Scott Thomas, Elizabeth Hurley, Tilda Swinton, Helena Bonham Carter, on and on and on, and they choose to go with not a Brit, but a Texan. There actually was, prior to you playing the part, a bit of a backlash, right? People were skeptical.
I wasn't really aware of that.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that I wasn't aware of that. I didn't really know. I just was curious if it was possible. And I asked Eric Fellner about that some years later. He's the producer of Working Title.
Yeah.
He's Englishman.
Yeah.
And he said that he had seen me at the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
And he thought I was such an odd, quirky person. I thought, who's this odd, quirky person? And I thought, I don't know how to take that, Eric.
Yeah, right, right.
Thank you.
Right.
The little question mark at the end.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, but flattering. I mean, flattering. I'll take that.
But
that's fine.
But it did put a little pressure on you to get the accent right, right?
You know, I don't know, because again, I wasn't really so aware of that. There were moments where I'd have flashes of it that I would come across, because it was my job when I was doing work experience at Picador.
Yes, you were working
publishing
as a
the publishers.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so I need to know Bridget's job.
Right.
So I would have to cut clippings for Helen Fielding, who was represented by the company, and put them in a file. That was part of my job. And every now and then I'd come across an article about the crap Texan comedian, you know. But otherwise, you know, there was a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
And the days were pretty full with, you know, trying to get things done.
And you had to eat a lot at that time.
Yes, there was lots of meals and there were lots and lots of dialect sessions.
Yeah.
We start in the morning before work. We met at lunch.
Yeah.
We met after work. We'd have dinner. We'd work after dinner.
Oh,
and it would start over again for months before we filmed. So I had a lot of help.
People obviously really loved you in that, and I first Oscar nomination, all of that. But I wonder what you make of the New York Times theory of why that worked so well. They say, speaking about you, quote, "She is always slightly sad when funny and slightly funny when sad," close quote. And I've seen a lot of other directors or collaborators, people, they feel like you have this ability to play both of those things at the same time. Have you ever, is that a conscious thing?
No, but it sounds like I'm redundant.
No.
Scene one, you've seen them all.
No, I mean, I think it's a good thing.
Oh,
but
gosh.
Anyway, we're obviously at this time here around Judy, but obviously the first time you were singing and dancing in front of a lot of people would be Chicago. And how did that come about? Because to my knowledge, that wasn't something you were known for, that you'd studied, that you'd done a lot of. So why did they think you could do it?
Chicago?
Yeah.
I don't know.
They never said.
No, I don't know.
And it's Rob, a choreographer?
Yes, Rob, the choreographer and director.
Yeah.
He's a phenomenally talented man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wanted to meet in New York. And so we went to meet. And we tinkered around a little bit on a makeshift kind of on a studio stage, I guess, dance rehearsal space, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And he showed me just a few steps just to introduce the style, the Fosse style to me.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that he was watching to see if I could pick it up.
Did you think you could do it immediately, or did it take some convincing for you even?
I knew I wanted to try.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know if I knew what I was doing or whether it was a good idea.
Right.
But, you know, I figured, well, I could just take that chance at someone else's expense.
Right. $45 million here or there, whatever. And the singing aspect of it all?
It was quick, I remember. It was really quick. We went up to Canada and we started in Toronto in October of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
It was right after 9/11.
Right.
And we went up and we started rehearsals then. And I believe we started to film right after Thanksgiving. So it was quite quick. It was training camp, you know, and we had all these little stations set up where you'd do your solo here, you'd go in there and do the group dance, and then you go into singing in the front room and work on vocal performances, and then you come over here. You know, everything was happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
It was,
yeah.
And we would rotate. Okay, now you're on the main floor with this number, with the dancers, and then so-and-so goes to the singing class. It was like that.
Did you have to see the movie completed to believe that it was going to come together, or did you sense it during the making of it at a certain point, this is gelling into something special?
It felt so special to me from the start.
Yeah.
It felt so special to me. I mean, just the visuals and the camera, the complicated camera moves that he was doing and the way that he makes the stage performances with the narrative, and it was so beautifully imagined.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no expectation for what it would become in its completion.
Yeah.
And I was astounded. I was astounded and so grateful. I was so grateful because, I mean, that is the representation of what we got to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt like I'd won the Olympics after we wrapped the Roxy number,
right.
You know, because all that stuff had come together at once. And then when it did, I felt like I did the landing on the beam of a lifetime, you know? And there were highs like that every day. And then to see how beautifully moving it was and how profound.
It was one of the first times I've ever been in a movie where it gets applause in the middle of a movie. That just doesn't happen. And, well, it happened in Judy, too. But
way to go, Rob.
Yeah, Rob.
Way to go, Rob.
Best Picture Oscar there. Then, interestingly, right after that, you're on the heels of that. Down with Love was interesting. People don't, I think, remember enough. Like, it's sort of a pillow talk kind of cool, old-fashioned thing.
I remember we got the news. It's being released on this day.
Yeah.
Everybody, get ready. And we'd be like, oh, what else is being released that day? Oh, well, we're doing counter-programming, so it's going to be great. And then, like, yeah, but what else is opening up on that day? And then it's like, oh, well, just The Matrix 2. But it's going to be great.
Oh, no. So got a little lost. But people...
I was like, wait, no, you can't do that because I'm going to The Matrix 2 on opening day. And my mom and my brother and, you know.
The whole town. Well, so, yeah, it was sad because it got a little lost. But it's interesting when people did end of the year lists, end of the decade lists of best movies, it was actually showing up in a number of places. But the other one that year is the one that I think is going to probably be remembered and associated with you a little longer, which is Cold Mountain for Anthony Minghella. It was great in Telluride to be able to be refreshed about what an entrance your character Ruby makes in that movie with the chicken and everything there. And I guess I just wonder what you saw as your responsibility in that movie. What was this as a character who you won the supporting actress Oscar? It was not necessarily the central character in the movie, but it was an extremely important one who has to come in and deliver. How did you see that one?
I loved this book.
Yeah.
I read the galleys of this book before it was released. I wanted, with my then boyfriend, who's a director, to acquire the option, which was impossible because after this weekend Newsweek report, you know, on how spectacular the book, the rather review was.
Yeah,
this is $1 million. And we're like, well, that was a nice dream.
Right.
But I love that book. And I followed it for years, 5 years, I'd followed it. I actually met Anthony Minghella at the Empire Awards in England. Because Cameron Crowe was receiving an award and he couldn't go, and he asked me if I would accept it on his behalf. And it was just, I don't know, one of those moments when the universe intervenes, and Anthony was on the stage and he walked over to me and he said, hello, I'm Anthony. And I said, hi. And he said, I heard you love Cold Mountain. And I said, yes. Good night.
Good night.
Way to work it, Zellweger.
Right, right, right.
But we met again,
yep.
And we talked about it. I don't know, it was a sensory experience for me reading that book. I love the history. I love Charles Frazier's music and his words. I love how he captures the smell of the place. And he described that period in American history in a way that I had never considered it before. I was so in love with this piece of material. And then I fell in love with Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, so here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking...
Ruby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, I'd never considered that. Really, you think?
Country girl. Was it the Texas accent that made it? What do you think made him think that?
I don't know.
Wow. Well, it was...
I don't know, but I'm so grateful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so let me just come back for a minute to the Oscar. What is the significance of something like that to you? Some people act like it's nothing and they claim they use it as their bathroom doorstop or whatever. I don't buy that. I think it's, what does it symbolize? That acceptance by your peers or the industry, or like, it just, what did that mean to you to get that recognition?
That's a really good question. I don't know that I've actually ever asked myself that question. I mean, there's the obvious that somehow you've been included in the historical record of cinema.
Yeah.
And that's pretty special, considering you have no expectation to be invited on the studio lot. So that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
And that you've been part of something that really mattered to you creatively and personally.
Yeah.
That resonates with other people.
Yeah.
And that's...
That was a great... I remember very clearly that was an exciting one just to see, because I think a lot of people wanted that for you the year before, even with Chicago. So to have those two in back-to-back years, and at least one of them, it was nice to see happen there. And
that's a kind thing.
No, well, sure. And then it was back for another Bridget Jones, which was Edge of Reason in 2004. Very good one. Another Cinderella Man, which... I think for a variety of reasons, maybe wasn't as loved as it should have been, but it was a great, great one.
I loved it.
It's so good.
I thought Russell Crowe was phenomenal in that role.
Yep.
And I thought what Ron Howard did, oh my gosh, I think it's one of the great boxing films. And I can
absolutely
say that, you know, objectively, take me out and just the footage.
Oh, it's fantastic. I loved it.
And how he recreated that period and how he captured life in that moment of, you know, desperation and depression in America.
Oh,
is
great.
Yeah, right. Way to go, Ron.
And then Miss Potter, which I had mentioned earlier, it's interesting because, you know, speaking of, we're going to come in a moment to this hiatus that you've just come out of. But I mean, Chris Noonan had done Babe, but nothing between Babe and Miss Potter. That's 11 years of a gap for him. And this one, you're playing Beatrix Potter, and I thought it was a quiet, but like another very interesting, another British character, but totally different, Victorian era. And what drew you to that one?
Oh, it's a gorgeous story.
Yeah.
And what an interesting, historically significant person.
Yeah.
I mean, she was one of the original conservationists.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, putting all of her money into the National Trust and land investment and land preservation. And everybody has her to thank for the Lake District, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a gorgeous story. It's hard to believe that it's true.
Yeah.
And she was a pioneer.
Totally.
She made her own money. She was the first person to be included in, what is it, the Victoria and Albert Museum for her work as a naturalist, you know?
Right.
Her sketches are still there as reference points because they were so meticulous and correct.
Right.
I mean, she was, what an extraordinary person.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you came out of essentially 6 years of not working in this business, or in front of the camera, we could say. I want to ask why that began. I know that right before it, like you've actually had far fewer movies that haven't done well than probably most people. You have the higher batting average than most people, but there were right before that a few that, through no fault of your own, probably didn't go over as well as you guys might have wanted, like a Leatherheads, which Clooney joked about when we had him on. And just,
I loved it.
It was, yeah.
I loved it.
And I know, I suspect you also like New in Town and My Own Love. So there were things.
Oh, yes.
But was that even a contributing factor to why you said, you know what, I need to take a break?
No. Oh, no.
What was that?
No, all of that. You know, it's none of my business. Once it's done...
Yeah, you do the work.
Yeah. And what motivates me to be involved has been the same since the beginning.
Yeah.
And I felt honored to be part of those experiences and to make those films. And I'm glad we made them.
Yeah.
And I love them all for different reasons.
Right.
And the friends that I made on them and the life experiences. And no, I stopped because I didn't feel gratitude in the way that I should anymore. When I was sitting in the trailer by myself on a holiday, and I felt like I had run dry in terms of life experiences that I had to draw from to authentically tell the stories of these characters. Felt like I essentially dove in at 27, 26, mm-hmm. 25, and I didn't stop until I was 40-something.
Was that you pushing yourself? Was that somebody saying, don't take your foot off the pedal because you never know if you'll be able to get it back on it? Like, why were you going that hard for so long?
Because the list of things that you just talked about were so exceptional that I would deeply regret having stepped away.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessary at that time.
Right.
I knew that I was tired.
Yeah.
And I knew that I missed my family, and I knew that I really didn't know where I lived, have that house, but I don't live there.
Right.
But I didn't feel the consequences of it yet. It took a lot more time before I started to recognize the consequences of it, probably around Beatrix Potter. I started to be like, girl, you're tired. Mm-hmm. And you're like, this is not, you can't keep doing this. You can't sleep for 3 hours a night for 4 months
right.
to do your job right and then go on a press tour
right.
or put on a pretty heel and supposedly look pretty because good luck, you know?
Right.
Flying from, you know, overseas right. for the weekend and smiling as if, you know.
It's all great.
Yeah.
yeah.
You can't keep doing that. And so I thought, right, you need to just sit down for a minute. And you don't have to understand everything today. And you don't have to make decisions about where things go. You just have to stop and be still so that you can hear those messages.
I think, you know, I'm only bringing this up because I saw you've spoken about it in other... There's no reason to not feel okay with that. I've been to therapists. A lot of people have been to therapists. You've said that it was helpful to you in reaching the conclusion that this needed to happen, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, he pointed it out to me. I saw a gentleman in New York who a
yeah.
girlfriend of mine had mentioned
yeah.
I might find interesting.
Yeah.
And I liked how she approached it. It wasn't like...
That sounds like setting you up for a date.
A date, right? right. Well, she just thought perspective is important.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this gentleman is so smart, not just you know, wise through
right.
experience, but he's just he's an intellectually, what's the word?
Yeah, multifaceted.
Thank you,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I enjoyed the conversations with him.
Yeah.
And through these conversations, you know, we weren't like regurgitating the boring details of my life and with, you know, weeping on the couch
right,
or something
right,
like
right.
that. We were just having conversations
yeah.
and
yeah.
some of his observations were very enlightening to me. And he pointed out, do you realize this?
That basically you didn't have very many hours of your day where you were just yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That all the decisions that I made
right.
that are of great significance in a life
yeah.
had very little to do with me
right.
and everything to do with this job and the public persona that sort of enters the room before I do.
So when you decided, all right, I'm taking a break, did you have any sense in your mind of how long that would be for? What did your people around you that you're close with, family, friends, you know, representatives or whatever, what did they make of this?
Well, I mean, there were other things to consider
yeah.
that my family and friends were concerned with.
Yeah.
You know, like when your friend is haggard and mm-hmm. and can't see the forest for the trees, mm-hmm. there's heartbreak in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that sort of surface and take priority in terms of how your friends are looking at your life
yeah.
and the experiences they're sharing with you. Very different.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with the job.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the, you know, conversations about why it's a bad idea and don't make that choice right now, and especially not right now, because now, you know, maybe... But it doesn't matter. It didn't matter
but
at that point.
Did you imagine at that point this is going to be 6 months and I'm back? Or what did you knew it was going to be a long time?
No, I didn't have clarity at that moment about why it was necessary.
Yeah.
And I needed to figure that out first. I needed to have a moment and try different things. I was curious. For years, I've been wanting to do other things,
mm-hmm.
but there was never time because there was always leaving.
Right.
So I have this great desk and a bunch of things that I'd begun to write, and I can't finish them ever because I'm always leaving them behind.
Comes back to you wanting to be a writer potentially before any of this, right?
Yeah.
And so that was part of what you did during those 6 years. I think you were writing and developing a TV show.
Yes.
But how were you spending your time for those 6 years? That's a small part of it, it sounds like.
Well, I stopped running so that I could see what it was really like to be in a relationship where you share a town.
Yeah.
and I, you know, built a home. Mm-hmm. I fell in love, adopted some dogs, created the TV show, did some development work for Bridget Jones' baby, which started in, like, I guess 2010, the conversations.
Yeah.
So that was ongoing.
And then,
so
I think you went to back to school.
I did.
I had read two things. I don't know if they're both correct. One of them was that it was for a non-entertainment-related classes, and then there was one about screenwriting. Is that both?
No, I didn't take a screenwriting class.
Okay, I didn't think so. But so it was, what was the subject that you were studying?
I went to study public policy.
Why that?
Because I'm fascinated.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is there a way to continue to employ what you learned from that moving forward?
For me personally?
Yeah.
I might like to build on it.
Yeah. So it was positive those 6 years. You weren't in any way, were you missing this?
Well, it was necessary.
Yeah.
And then I have to ask you another question.
Yeah.
Does anybody wonder where Daniel Day-Lewis goes?
Well, we hear these stories. You hear he's a cobbler in Ireland, or you hear these random, we didn't really hear anything from, which is a credit to you, really, you were effective at shutting out this other, the public side. There would always be these rumblings about, and there's been different reports about what he was doing. But yeah, it's an unusual, because it's so uncommon, but probably healthy to not go 150 miles per hour for 30 years in a row, right?
But, probably.
So what was the, you said Bridget Jones's baby was the first one that you were thinking about coming back for. And it was the first one that actually, that was in 2016. I guess one thing I want to, just to tie a loose thread or whatever they say. You had mentioned earlier Nancy Ryder was the publicist that you hired at the very beginning.
Yes.
And one of the things that I know, because I'm my good friend Chris Gardner is somebody who I think you know as well.
He's so wonderful.
He's covered this crazy journey that Nancy has been on since 2014, I think. She just had come through breast cancer and now gets an ALS diagnosis. And I know from Chris and other people, part of what you were doing during these years was being a very good friend to her.
Yeah, there was some advocacy work that that she wanted to participate in. Mm-hmm. And so I shared that with her.
Yeah.
I'm sharing that with her.
Yeah.
I think the walk is, what is it? It's in November this year. You can look on the ALS Association website.
The ALS walk, yeah.
It's really worth coming because, boy, it just, I don't know. Your faith in humanity will be bolstered. Yeah. You will leave a changed person.
Wow. Well, I definitely plan to do that. And so I guess just coming to the present, you came back with Bridget Jones's baby. You had What If, which I think was actually shot after Judy from what I heard earlier today. But
yes.
But that came out first, the series on Netflix. And Bridget Jones, by the way, is like, that's probably the longest gap between, aside from Star Wars, between installments in a series to come back 12 years later. I was curious what it's like to step back into that. I was curious what it's like to do TV for the first time. But then, of course, like to get somebody raising the idea that you should play Judy Garland. So this crazy year or so of those things, just if you can, how they came at you.
Okay, wow. That is a good series of questions. Okay, start at the beginning. The first one you talked about, Bridget Jones and the
gap. 12 years later to step back in.
Well, I loved Lucy in Black and White in the New York apartment, and I loved it when they moved to California, right? And they had the backyard barbecue thing, and then I loved her in Technicolor working at the bank.
Right.
And it felt like, wow, what a life blessing to get to portray a character in different life stages, telling stories that are relatable to an audience who love her like you do and can share those stories with you together.
Yep.
I mean, come on. How special is that?
And people, absolutely, they've loved having you come back to that. And then,
well, I'm talking about Bridget Jones, Helen Fielding's
Jones. I see what you're saying.
Because I love her too.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I love her on the pages as much as getting to play her.
Right.
Which is, you know.
And then What If in those 6 years that you'd been away, TV had suddenly become, You know, it used to be the sort of place you ended up if things weren't going well. Now it's the place that it's like as hot as anything, right? I mean, earlier in your career, would you have ever thought you would want to do TV?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Good is good.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no discounting the things that you've loved all your life,
yeah,
and me too, that we still reference and look for reruns, you yeah know, anywhere.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, and then Judy. So, like, I was lucky to be in that audience the first night in Telluride, world
you
premiere.
You were.
Absolutely.
You were there?
Of course.
And well, thanks. That's so nice.
I wasn't going to miss that. I honestly will say, like, I think a lot of people that are familiar with you and then they see what Judy Garland looked like and just the way it's unlike anything we've ever seen you do before, even though we've seen you sing and we've seen you dance. We do it. So I guess I was like kind of in the back of my head, I've got to see this to believe it. And like everybody else who's seen it was just totally blown away. And I guess I just wonder, though, whose idea was it that this was even feasible, that you could be made to look and sound and all these things like her?
David Livingstone, the producer.
The producer, it started with him?
Yeah, I'd worked with him a long time ago, mm-hmm, back in the early 2000s, mm-hmm, I guess. And he sent it to John Carbino, who read it and mm-hmm loved it, and called me and said, you got to read this. And I thought, why did they send it to me? You know, I'm not a performer like that. I don't, you know. And he said, just read it. Like he's done many times in the years. Just read it. And I read it, and I found it to be a really beautiful story. I mean, despite its subject matter, which from the outside you can say, yes, these circumstances are tragic. But what the story tries to do is contextualize it.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, I came out of reading that thinking, oh, she's so much more extraordinary than I knew.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciated why they wanted to make this film. And I talked to David, and he said, well, just come to England, and we'll just try something. Just come. And they said, well, we'll go to Abbey Road. I'm like, stop right there. What time's the flight?
Right.
We're going to go to Abbey Road.
Right.
This is like Tom Cruise. And they're going to let us in.
Right.
Yes, please.
That's cool.
Yeah, so we went, I went, and we went, and we tried some things.
You think they were feeling out, can she sing like this?
Absolutely, just like Rob Marshall.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Had you prepped to make sure you could already at that point?
He sent me some recordings from some of her concerts later in life.
Yeah.
And he sent me the ones where I think she was probably most vocally compromised.
Uh-huh.
And so it was quite different, you know, octave lower, maybe two,
right,
and talking some of the words instead of singing them,
mm-hmm,
and really reaching for them, and they kind of crack a little bit. And I think that was by design that he sent me those recordings.
Yeah.
But that's what we were trying to do. And I say we because it was, the whole thing was this cooperative effort. It was always David there and Rupert, the director, always. And Eric Vitro, the vocal coach, and Mark, the vocal coach in London, and Matt Dunkley, who was the composer, always there.
And so, once you guys decided you're going to take the leap, let's try to do this, I did read that you probably, as usual, went off and did your own additional research and homework and all of that. And I guess I wonder what that entailed and what, if anything, most surprised you about this woman who lived her whole life without taking the hiatus that probably would have been very healthy for her. I mean, you wonder if she might have made it had she done something like that, made it a little bit longer in life.
Well, it does make you reflect a little bit. But I don't know that she thought that was a possibility.
Yeah, right.
For
that's
her.
What the film kind of, yeah. There, you could, that's where I guess you can't take your foot off the.
No.
But I mean, what I read that you were watching interviews and other stuff beyond the script. What was the most valuable?
There was an interview that she did with Barbara Walters, mm-hmm, with her children, Lorna and Joey, and her vulnerability in that interview broke my heart. She was holding on to her children in a way that seemed like she was just so frightened. And you could tell that she felt misunderstood and she was afraid that she would be misrepresented. And... I'm sorry.
No problem.
I get these robocalls in a foreign language that we don't recognize quite a lot.
You should...
I should have pushed play.
No, I was going to say, you could, yeah, let them speak. You had me at hello.
That's pretty good, actually.
Anyway,
my new voicemail. It never occurred to me. My new voice message.
Sorry. Next time you get a robocall. Anyway, sorry. You were giving this whole thought.
No. So you had asked about what was most important, and that one really seemed to give insight into where she was at that moment.
One of the things, though, that I couldn't help but wonder watching this is that turns out, like, throwing bread rolls and stuff at her and just being people were mean in some. I mean, she was obviously a beloved person by most people, but there are also some mean people. And I wondered if, without getting into any more specifics than you feel like, if you could relate to that, having been around in this business for a few years and come across your own share of assholes, I'm sure. Could you put yourself into her shoes more easily because of that?
Yeah, I guess it's fair to say that I could empathize, that I know what that feels like.
I think there was one of these, I don't remember, maybe it was the Dick Cavett interview with her, which I know you had talked about, so I went and watched it, where she's saying like something about comebacks. Where
every time I go to the bathroom, they call it a comeback. She's funny.
Mean, was that?
She's funny.
That idea also, though. I mean, people are supposedly this is a. I mean, in a sense, it certainly is a great comeback role for you too. It's not that you were ever not great, but you had that sense in your own career where people use that word or that kind of way of looking at it.
I don't look at it that way.
Yeah.
You know, because these are real life experiences, going to England and making the list of things that you're hoping to achieve, mm-hmm. and then making more lists about the process that you need to commit to in order to achieve that. And there's a timeline, and there's a countdown to, and there's friends that you're making along the way, and there's not succeeding, and there's fear, and then there's the triumph of actually getting one of those things that you hope to in one of those little categories on the list.
Right.
And all of it involves this very fluid process of collaboration, mm-hmm. with all of these different departments. And you walk away, all of us, we all walked away from that just wanting to celebrate her, you know? And everybody was putting their hearts into this because of the affection that they have for her, mm-hmm. or a connection that they feel to the legacy of her work and an appreciation for her, mm-hmm. and wanting to just applaud her for what she's achieved and the importance of what she contributed, mm-hmm. you know? And that's how I look at it.
Yeah.
I got to be part of that celebration, and it was so cool.
Yeah.
It was so special, and I can't look at it any other way.
Well, the last question is just, there's such a transformation here with the physical stuff that you do. The songs, I think people should realize, are actually all you, which is not, it was amazing. I mean, there's, particularly I thought the By Myself number was just like a showstopper. But all of that, I guess just having then had put this out there where, I guess like a lot of things, it could have gone very wrong, but it went so right here where Telluride and everywhere since Toronto, people are talking about this in terms that, you know, you've had a lot of great successes, but a lot of people think this is the best thing you've ever done. So to be here in 2019 and having people say that, having been in this since you were 26 and just everything you've been through, what do you make of this particular moment?
I'm really grateful. I'm really, really grateful. I'm grateful for a new perspective. And I'm grateful for being able to have that experience that I just described to you, to share that with so many special people who I love. And I'm grateful that what we had hoped to do, mm-hmm. in terms of showing reverence seems to touch people and remind people of her importance in not just film history or the, you know, American music catalog, mm-hmm. but in American history.
Yeah.
And how many lives that she has inspired and influenced, and I'm grateful for that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And
thanks. It's good to see you.
Fun. You too.
Thanks for going to Telluride. That was really nice.
I mean, it was the highlight.
To me.
It was Telluride.
It's
Toronto.
Oh, that's
right. Yeah. I'm on the Renee Zellweger circuit. So
me too.
What's next?
I'll
see you down the road. All right. Thanks. Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg, and you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.